Welcome once again to Cinemaholics, the major motion podcast where we talk about the biggest and the best films coming to theaters and streaming online from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm John Negroni, film editor for InBetweenDrafts.com. And Will, what are you doing? Why are you dressed like that?
Good evening.
Is that a throne of blood bags?
Well, how'd you know?
Because it looks like a throne of blood bags.
Yeah. Normally, I don't find your gimmicks very funny, but this one actually got me, so congratulations.
Will Ashton from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, freelance film writer. And Will Ashton, it looks like you have somebody with you who's bringing you dead bodies to your feet.
He's
very familiar to me, though. We have to
bid him welcome, of course, because this is a Dracula-related...
He looks familiar.
Yeah, there you go. It is none other than returning guest, Clint Worthington.
Clint Worthington? But wait, Will, Clint Worthington's the editor-in-chief of The Spool and a senior staff writer of Consequence of Sound. Everybody knows that his bylines are everywhere.
It's true. In too many places, actually. I miss sleep. I should also clarify in the intro that I was not giving he was not sitting on a throne of blood bags. He was sitting on a bag of copies of Throne of Blood.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's even better, actually.
I know. It's very expensive. It's the Criterion ones. Like $40 a pop. Building a whole chair out of those is pretty expensive.
Clint Worthington, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It is a Tuesday, and so naturally my brain is in Tuesday brain. But I'm very excited to chat Cage with you guys and figure out the different modes of Cage.
It seems like you're the right guest to bring on for a Nicolas Cage episode, but why is that? Why would somebody be like, oh, that makes a lot of sense?
You'd think so, and that's probably because I'm the co-host of a podcast called Travolta Cage with my lovely close friend and pop culture writer extraordinaire Nathan Rabin, where for the last couple of years or so, we've been going chronologically through the films of one Sir John Travolta and one Sir Nicolas Cage, who obviously united in a beautiful marriage of acting prowess with Face Off, which led us down this rabbit hole of where do these two idiosyncratic movie stars intersect and diverge across the whole of their careers, because they've had very similar and yet very divergent careers at certain eras. And we're currently in the 2010s, which is a wild ride, especially for Travolta, who made so many fewer movies than Cage in this period. So now we're in a phase of like just doing a bunch of Cage double features. So we're waiting for old Johnny to catch up with us.
Well, I got to ask you, because I know you're a fan of Cage, but
of course.
Are you a fan of Travolta, too? Like, who would you pick out in the crowd?
I mean, obviously... Oh, go ahead, Clint.
Okay. One of those things is... It's kind of tough because, obviously, I think Cage is the clear winner. And that's kind of the thing we discovered early on in the podcast, where we're like, ooh, this is a fun idea. There'll be this battle of the wills. And then it was very early on that we realized, oh, Cage is going to win. But that's sort of the fundamental difference between the two performers, is that Cage is an actor, a capital A actor. He studies the craft. Travolta is more of a movie star, where he is someone who can be used well with the right charisma, whereas Cage can transform and transmogrify much in the way that he does in the movie we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there is something to be said about, like, also, I feel like, as you were saying, that because they're both fairly eccentric people, Travolta's taste, I can never really place, like, what he really thinks, like, a good script is or a good character is. I feel like Cage is actually very smart and very articulate. And I'm not saying Travolta isn't, but I feel like he has a deep love and understanding of film. Obviously, he's a Coppola. So I think he like knows what works, and he's just had like some rough patches where, he's had to pay some bills. He got some pyramids that weren't paid off. So it's just like, okay, like he'll kind of, do some things. But I also think he loves the hustle, and I think he loves to just do a challenge and really push himself as an actor. Whereas Travolta, I'll just see so many things where like, he's had so many ups and downs. And it's just like, is it just really the luck of the draw, or is he just like, just constantly pushing himself in different directions because he doesn't really know what works best for him or what's in his best interest? But I mean, sometimes it produces brilliant work, sometimes it produces terrible work, and sometimes it produces brilliantly terrible work.
Yeah, he doesn't quite get that he's at the end of the day a song and dance man. And I think every time he tries to veer away from that, he gets in trouble, especially when he tries to do the big character actor stuff. Like when he's trying to be a movie star, I think he can be used well. But then he'll do, especially later in his late career stuff like Battlefield Earth or even Gotti. Like he just doesn't get that he just doesn't have the range, and he just comes across as goofy when he's trying to take these big swings. He is one of those actors who kind of needs to stay in his lane. Whereas Cage, in whatever mode you put him in, is at least interesting. And he has so many different modes that he can rely on.
Now, his last major movie, Cage, was Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. That was the name of the movie?
Yes,
no, Unbearable
yes.
Weight of Massive Talent, which has been kind of blown up lately on like the TikToks and all that stuff. A lot of people have been using a meme from the movie with him and Pedro Pascal. And so, like, you know, that's kind of nice because the movie wasn't a big hit or anything. And we don't have to relitigate that movie. I think we have a whole episode about The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. But this is, like, interesting. It's, like, the first, like, post, like, mega meta movie about Cage where he plays himself. It even references Vampire's Kiss. So it's kind of interesting that we go right into Renfield. So I was just kind of curious if, like, anybody had any sort of, you know, before we get onto the Renfield train, is this the kind of movie you were expecting from Nick Cage afterward? I know that he has a bunch of other stuff coming out like this year.
I think maybe so. I wonder if, for me, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, like, it's kind of cute, but I think Cage is kind of in his Reddit phase a little bit, where he's leaning a little bit too much into the meme of himself, where there has always been an element of self-awareness to Nick Cage, which I appreciate. And I think that makes his roles way more interesting than people expect him to be at first blush. But with Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, like, I did struggle with the idea of Cage being so in on the joke that it removed the joke. I don't know. It was very tough. I felt for me it tipped the hand a little too far. And Renfield kind of feels in the same mold, where Cage feels like he was cast because wouldn't it be funny if Nick Cage played Count Dracula? Like, actually played a vampire instead of a businessman from the 80s who thought he was a vampire because capitalism rots our brains.
It's kind of like Nick Cage's manager is like the most online Redditor, you know, like out there right now.
Right. And you know what? Like, in theory, these are great ideas. I just don't know if Renfield used it in the way that I would have loved to have been used.
Well, let's set it up. Let's explain to the listeners what this movie is in case they haven't even seen the trailer. Let's do it. So Renfield, it's a horror action comedy, and it's directed by Chris McKay. I think the last big thing Chris McKay did was Lego Batman movie. Has he done anything besides that since? I'm forgetting, because that was years ago. That was the first.
You're forgetting about a little movie called The Tomorrow War, or whatever it was called.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that movie existed, and we did talk about it.
It was a nice way for a lot of LA comedians to get some work.
What an anonymous movie, though, in terms of who directed it. But Chris McKay, Lego Batman movie, which that was a movie famously. It was one of the first movies you and I ever talked about, Will, on Cinemaholics. It was the double feature we did with John Wick Chapter 2. First episode of Cinemaholics.
Wow, yeah. Kind of weird that within the last few weeks we're sort of revisiting that first episode in indirect ways.
I revisit it all the time. Every couple of months I listen to it again just to let my heart go a flutter. But no, Lego Batman movie, which I didn't find it that funny. I didn't really like the Lego Batman movie much, but all the critics were like, this is really great. It's just, you know, it's as good as the first Lego movie, whatever. But I disagree, but whatever. What are you going to do? We have Robert Kirkman of Walking Dead fame, who did the story for this. Ryan Ridley has the screenplay credit. And, you know, Clint already kind of touched on it. It's playing like a modern Dracula. Like in this movie, Dracula is something that still happened. Like it references directly the 1931 movie. But the idea is that Nicolas Cage is Dracula, and Renfield, his familiar who brings him like the innocent victims, and he gets bugs in return. It's been a century since all that happened. They're still doing their thing. They're still kind of like going through the motions of master and servant. But this is sort of like a modern, like, what if Renfield started to question all of that and starts going to a codependence anonymous support group thing. It's kind of taking the whole Dracula, like, metatextual sort of like what are the actual implications of this if you transport it into the 21st century and therapy speak and all of that. So that's where the comedy comes in, but it's also very bloody. There's a lot of action. There's a whole crime boss syndicate subplots that Renfield has empowers in this and has to contend with gangsters and things like that in New Orleans. And Awkwafina is also in this movie as a police officer, which is a choice. Now, I know we're going to play the Rotten Tomatoes game later. Will has already said that he's been spoiled on the Rotten Tomatoes score, so I feel okay, comfortable saying that so far, you know what, critics haven't been, you know, their blood isn't hot for Renfield. Let's say that. You know, this movie's been kind of getting hit from all sides. And as you all can't see this, but I'm wearing a Renfield shirt. I walked out of Renfield, you know, fist bumping the air, being like, I can't wait to talk about this movie with Will and Clint. They're going to love this movie too. And we'll start with you, Clint. Why should my heart be broken right now?
I think your heart should be broken because, and I mentioned this in my review too, that it's often, there's often a tendency with critics to lambast a movie for what the critic thinks it should be rather than what it is. And I try to avoid that as much as possible. But for me, Renfield was such a clear instance of there are two movies battling for supremacy here. And there is this sort of vestigial element of like gory kick-ass action comedy that doesn't feel like it fits with the Renfield Dracula story they're trying to take. Where it's just a matter of, I don't know. I just wish I could have just watched Nicholas Holt and Nick Cage do their therapy thing instead of having to shoehorn an awkward John Wickian actioner in here. Like, we didn't need, I didn't need a whole subplot about gangsters for this. I think it needed to be more intimate and weirder than this. And it felt like it sacrificed that on the altar of four quadrant accessibility. Like, it wasn't weird enough for me, if that makes sense.
I mean, Dracula should be weird. That is one thing that if a Dracula movie should have for it to work, it shouldn't be Dracula Untold, right? Because I don't remember much about that movie, but I do remember it being vanilla ice cream, which is, I mean, what you don't want.
I think Dracula's been told plenty of times at this point. You know, that novel came out before the 1900s. And what were they thinking that Dracula had never been told? That's ridiculous. That's why. Right. That's problem number one.
My primary problem with Dracula Untold is the inaccuracy of its title.
Yeah. Will Ashton, everyone knows you're a big fan of Dracula. You look up to him. He's been your inspiration. You want to be just like him.
Right here. I got the book.
You want people to call you the Prince of Darkness. Let us have it. You know, why was Renfield your favorite movie of 2023?
I mean, I was looking forward to it, if that's what you're getting at. And I think, you know, sort of answering a question you had before, I think the reason I was really excited about it was because the promise of Nicolas Cage playing Dracula is just almost too good to be true. Like, given not only his love of theatricality, but love of German expressionism, the love of supernatural, the way he really infuses himself into a character such as this one, it just seemed like a very natural fit for Nicolas Cage to play Dracula. And I think seeing those early set photos where he was like done up in what looked to be, you know, ready for like a more stylistic black and white sort of presentation that we, I guess, eventually saw at the beginning of the film, you had to wonder like, oh, is this going to really dive into something that's a little bit, you know, stylistic and bold and doing something that really just kind of almost feels like maybe something like Robert Eggers would do or something. And maybe kind of fittingly so, since he's doing Nosferatu right now. But yeah, I mean, the movie itself, I knew that that's that wasn't what we're going to get, because the trailer really leaned more into like, okay, don't forget this movie is written by one of the writers of Rick and Morty. Like, you know, it's going for a very specific tone, and it's playing with this premise, obviously, where Renfield is obviously in this codependent abusive relationship and he's trying to get out of it. And that already is a very tricky tone to accomplish, especially for an action comedy such as this one. And so on the onset, you're like, okay, this movie really needs to strike a very kind of gentle but firm tone that I just don't think the people involved were really prepared to do. And I think that is in part because, like what Clint's saying, it feels like it's doing too much with so little time. It's biting off more it can chew, if you will. Like, it's trying to do all these things. I've heard people say it has kind of like a Max Landis quality to it, and that like it's like, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this, in a way it's like, okay, like, let's just focus
that
on two
the
of these
meanest
things.
Thing you can absolutely say about a movie, by the way. Like, wow.
But I think that, I mean, that wasn't I wasn't the one that came up with that, to be fair. But I think there is that that kind of quality where it's just like, okay, it seems like it's not really content to be one thing. I don't know if that's the studio really being enforceful of it, or if that's just the people involved who are a little skittish about doing something that has like a very dark premise and doing it in a kind of flippant way as this. But I mean, the comedy just came across as kind of glib and a little self-satisfied. I think Cage is a hoot. I mean, Cage is undeniably the best thing about this movie. And I would say, no matter what complaints I have about the movie, it's worth seeing for his performance, as well as Nicholas Hoult. I really do think he gives it his all. I think he is a good pair with Nicholas Cage. They're reuniting. I just remembered this from The Weatherman, which I think is one of Cage's most underrated movies. And it was just really nice to see. They have a really good working dynamic together. But everything else around it, I don't think the comedy really works. The action is very choppy, and it feels like it is fun, the gore. Like, I love the slapdash element of it. I love how over the top it is, but I feel like it doesn't really establish any stakes or style outside of that. And then I also think that the mob element, as we're mentioning, just feels not only superfluous, but just sort of odd, and just never really collectively tones with what else the film is doing. And I think it ultimately undermines what I think is really working, which is that Nicolas Cage, Nicholas Hoult element, the Nick element.
The Knicks.
It's not like an unwatchable movie. It's pretty well paced. Like, it goes at a good clip. You can definitely tell they edited it down to the 90 minutes that it is now. And like, there's tons of ADR. There's a lot of story plots that just feel like those truncated. And then even like the credits, like there's like this big musical number that they show that like wasn't in the film at all. So I don't really know what all got left on the cutting room floor. But yeah, it just feels like a kind of messy, unfocused film, but not without its pleasures, which I hope we can discuss when you talk about all the things you love about the movie, John.
For sure. I mean, it's kind of funny because, like, as much as I like this movie, one of the movies I thought of during it was Sorcerer's Apprentice, and how I was like, man, Nicholas Hoult does this way better, or like jives with Nick Cage so much better than Jay Baruchel. Like, no disrespect to the guy.
What are you saying? That I didn't get along well with Nicolas Cage? Like,
it just seemed like you guys just weren't.
I thought we had some good chemistry going.
Oil and water a little bit. I don't know.
I mean, the funny thing about Sorcerer's Apprentice for me, and not to get off topic, but I just love the idea that like Disney had to be like, who is the modern day Mickey Mouse? And they're like, Jay Baruchel. Yes.
But look, I think for me, the surprise of this movie was Hoult a little bit, because this is one of those movies where I did kind of see the trailer. Like, usually when trailers come on, I try to ignore them because I don't want to watch trailers most of the time. But I did catch a little bit of like Hoult and like the therapy group or whatever. There's like a line in the trailer that didn't make it to the movie about how he does, he basically does Dracula's Postmates, which, kind of speaks to what you're talking about, Will, but they really seem to like punch up the script with like random jokes like that all throughout. Very noticeable, very noticeable. But I think like with Hoult, I always fall for the guy because of his performances in things like Warm Bodies and Mad Max, The Favorite, where he's all pale and kind of vulnerable, but also despicable. And I just, I think that it's like a guy who knows his strengths, which kind of works in a movie with Nick Cage, who's kind of the same way. You know, it's like a love him or hate him kind of thing. So they just seem to be like a perfect pair. My whole take on this is that, while I was watching the movie, I suspect that if they had really committed to the whole like master-servant toxic relationship stuff too much, I think it would have been way too repetitive. I think that, it would have just been not enough plot. And maybe some people would say that's like, that's the point. Like, you can't really stretch this to a movie. This is an SNL skit. This would be funny, like just have Renfield in the support group and it ends with like Nick Cage showing up as Dracula and killing everyone. That's your setup, isn't it? And I do get the sense that they wanted to, because this is Universal. They've been trying to do a dark universe. They've been trying to do the Marvel thing with their monsters over and over. And they've tried so many different things. They've tried The Mummy. They've tried the Dracula Untold, like we mentioned. They've tried, the Wolfman. Do we do it really serious? No. We'll do it sort of like harkening back to the Brendan Fraser Mummy. No. We're going to do it just like a
Marvel
movie.
Going back to Max Landis, they did the Victor Frankenstein thing.
Oh, that I forgot
James
about
McAvoy
that one too.
And Daniel Radcliffe. Everyone else did except me, because I'm cursed with that knowledge forever.
I do remember that trailer, though.
You know who wrote that movie?
Yeah, Max Landis.
Yes,
hence there you go. What I prefaced with, yeah.
Yeah,
there you go. So to me, though, like this kind of movie, I think that's what they were going for, where they're like, all right, well, this can't just be this like esoteric 80 minute, or I guess shorter than 80 minutes if you just did like a really small sort of short film version of this. It's like, we have to add in, you know, we have to make Renfield likable. We have to sort of be like, well, he's not the most evil person in this movie, because otherwise, like, the movie's morals don't really make a lot of sense, because like, he's basically like a serial killer, right? They reference that directly, and like his like path to redemption is very strange in this movie. And I think it's one of those things where they just didn't know where to go with it. So they're like, all right, well, just don't let the movie take itself too seriously. And my suspicion is that that's what's throwing people off. It's like, well, if this movie's so silly, if this movie doesn't take itself seriously, then why should I care? Why should I be invested in this like mob boss subplot, which is trying to be a little bit more serious? There's no, you know, good cops or anything in this whole town. And I get that. I think for me, it still really works, because I just think that the gags work, because the gags kind of propel everything along. And I think that when you have like the mob boss stuff, the Awkwafina stuff, it's not my favorite part of the movie, but they are breathers. Like, I just felt like, okay, we're going to go to this, and then, you know, I'm eating my vegetables so that we can have more of a movie, and that Renfield can have this big set piece where he breaks people's bodies apart in very vicious ways. And for me, it was worth it. It was like worth the pain of some like very mandated studio stuff, because I think that they're trying to go in this direction of like, oh, we're going to do like these kind of like gory, like action comedies for these monsters as a way, because that'll be more appealing to people instead of this like serious gothic thing. And to be clear, I don't think that that's the right move. Like, taking the Universal monsters and putting in the modern day, it's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, I don't think that that'll ever work. They should just do like period pieces, me personally.
Here's my rebuttal to that. I think it's possible for vegetables to taste good.
You know they what I mean? Tasted good, like, to me. Yeah. I guess I put those Brussels sprouts in the air fryer. You guys in wrong. I don't know.
Well, this was just like blandly steaming Brussels sprouts for the Awkwafina stuff, especially. I mean, I feel like Awkwafina is just like, I don't know what that actress or that character is doing here. Like, apart from it being kind of a, I guess, somewhat of a romantic foil, and also this connection to the real world. But yeah, it just feels like she's the protagonist of her own separate movie that collides with Renfield's in a way that feels extremely vestigial. And I felt like so much of her interaction with the story was just, well, that just happened-esque observations. Like, oh man, that sure is a lot of blood. You just did X. Like, I felt like half of her dialogue is kind of her describing the outrageous things we've just seen back to us to put a hat on the hat for the joke.
No, but see, what I liked is like when she would yell at people randomly, especially the other police officers, you know, I was like, okay, well, if you're going to do this, like, if you're going to have Awkwafina, you might as well lean into that.
I guess. Yeah. I think it would have been nice to have had more of a human, to have her serve as more of a human connection than she really did. But, you know, because it's sometimes in some of their interactions, she and Nicholas Holt have like a halfway okay chemistry. But also, again, it's so rushed that you're running to the next set piece before it happens. And going back to the whole sort of idea of the story being about reconciling Renfield being a serial killer with making him good, the way they make him good is by having him murder more people in a really violent way. And yeah, sure, they're bad.
That's Hollywood.
People. It's Hollywood, but still, like, but in a story literally about how a devious sort of reptilian familiar guy can learn to get out of the sort of complicit evil that he enacts and become virtuous and good, it feels like a weird tack to take, especially when you're just, I just felt like this movie occasionally tried to be a Kingsman movie. And that dissonance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially that fight in Renfield's apartment felt like they were trying to just basically do like the church scene from Kingsman, even down to characters like reacting on it on the TV as it's happening.
And I think
to the point where I looked for Mark Millar's name in the credits.
Oh yeah, no. I think I said in my review that the scriptwriter was bitten by a radioactive Mark Millar. It was pretty wild. Like. And again, like, I think I wouldn't be as mad about the action scenes had they been, they seemed decently choreographed. And again, I did like the out there gore that they did. I'm glad that we had rivulets, like just gallons and gushes of blood and people's getting faces getting ripped off. That stuff was great. I wish I could see the rest of the fighting. That was the thing. The whole thing was like edited to pieces and chopped up. And I'm just sort of like, I don't have a sense of geography here. Then again, we are like just a couple weeks out from having seen like John Wick Chapter 4. So maybe I'm spoiled.
I definitely disagree with that. I thought the choreography was quite nice.
The choreography was good. I wish the editing I had a problem with.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with Clint there, because it feels like both this movie and Cocaine Bear, because they're both Universal movies, there is somebody at Universal who's like, we need to mandate that these movies are 95 minutes or less. Like, you got to cut whatever you can cut to make that work. And it feels like they had to like cut any second that they felt was superfluous. And I think that does really come down to Awkwafina's storyline, where I think there was, in the initial story, I think there was an attempt to kind of make them the parallel protagonists. They're both two characters who are trying to overcome their deep-seated trauma through each other. But I think because they're like, well, we got to cut something. We're not going to cut the Renfield stuff, because the movie is called Renfield. It's not called Awkwafina Cop. So they got to, you know, cut the stuff with Awkwafina, which is fine, but and it doesn't really work for me in general, because I just think her performance doesn't really feel fitting for the film. Like, it is like very over the top when it's trying to be dramatic, and it's also kind of understated when it's trying to be comedic, and then, like you said, it's kind of going for both at times. But yeah, I mean, I just don't think that really works, because it's so truncated and it's just not really smoothly intersected into the story. And also just feels kind of half-baked in general. Like, it doesn't really feel fully fleshed out to begin with. So I think there's a lot here on paper that makes sense. It's just that you got to get that tone right. And I just think between the editing and the director not really being in full control of the tone, it just doesn't feel like it's quite capturing what it wants to capture here.
Yeah, like, I get that the movie is sort of centered around a basic, like, single, what I think is an interesting joke, right? But I feel like I think the movie itself needs to lean into the joke and take the joke seriously for it to be funny. But where it is, where, like, the Rick and Morty writer comes in and all of the tonal shifts, it feels like it's soaked in so many layers of irony that they're not letting me in. They're not letting me into this idea. Like, my spitballed idea for what a good Renfield movie of this type would have been was something similar to what you said, where it was, like, sort of an SNL sketch length thing. But I think you could still make it work where the support group is the framing device, and we're getting all, like, and so the rest of the movie can be the flashbacks leading up to that moment of watching those things. And, like, the joke is, again, as John said, like, the therapy speak, where the gag is, what if these kinds of horror relationships were filtered through the kind of obnoxious, sometimes, like, overly clinical therapeutic language we use to describe relationships in 2023. Like, this felt like a horror movie version of that one person who used that, I'm sorry, I can't hold space for this friendship anymore, you know? And that, I think that gag is funny, but then they realized there wasn't enough movie there, so they had to tack on, like, an action movie to make it a theatrical release.
I think that's the thing, is that they, you know, that would be more the Robert Eggers version, wouldn't it?
Like, right.
You know, but even, not even Robert Eggers, but
and
yeah.
And that's betraying my tastes too, yeah.
I think, yeah, they probably just saw that, like, all right, well, general audiences are, you know, they're going to want a little bit more sort of like their way in, you know, into a movie like this, which is like, what do people like? The, you know, police
what
versus
if Renfield
monsters.
Punched and so they people in. A lot.
And, you know, like, I think for me, a lot of that stuff still, you know, works fine. You know, I felt like I was just able to overlook a lot of the functional stuff, because I was connecting so much with where this movie, I just think, was so fun and so silly and, like, actually, like, delivered its promises. Like, every time, I guess it just, like, kept winning me back. I have a toxic relationship with this movie, almost. Like, I just feel like it keeps winning me back, you know, and there were moments in this where I did feel that, like, oh man, if this was a little bit longer, if you could really do more with, like, with the Shorey Agdashlu character, yeah, where you just feel like there's more going on there. Like, she has this, like, kind of brief little speech about, like, how their criminal organization isn't even, like, the biggest, you know, in the city, but it's the most feared. And I was like, man, I kind of want, like, a scene or two establishing right. that. I don't want to just be told.
And I
that.
Always want to root for Shorey Agdashlu, because I'm a huge Expanse fan and she's just a fucking queen. But yeah, she doesn't get much to do here.
And then there's Ben Schwartz, who I'll admit, like hearing Sonic, you know, say all those cusses, that was difficult. I didn't have a fun time.
Yeah, did that hurt your delicate ears? Yeah, I did just see right before hopping on. I think Ben Schwartz like just shared a clip of behind the scenes footage from Renfield that where it was just him and Nicolas Cage having fun. This fun little 30-second clip, and like he finally got permission from Universal to post it. And it's a delightful little thing. I think they probably had fun making this. For sure. I just think it got lost in the edit, I think.
Now, this movie, I think it's going to be a big old flop. It's only made $10 million so far, and it's a $65 million budget. So this movie is probably going to be a pretty big hit in the wrong direction for Universal. Yep. I think for it to be successful, I mean, it needed to make like $30 million at least. And even then, it probably would have been an uphill battle. So yeah, it's not looking good for Renfield.
Yeah, because didn't Pope's Exorcist actually outgross Renfield this past weekend?
Pope's Exorcist? I'll look that up. I didn't see the box office for it. But if so, and that's genuinely yikes.
Right. Yeah, Pope's Exorcist, have you seen it, though?
Is it good?
It's a bog-standard Exorcist movie, but Russell Crowe's in it having a blast. Incredible.
Sarah Vincent is reviewing it for us at In Between Drafts, so... that's going to be out soon in case people are interested. $36 million at the box office so far. I don't know if that's counting though, because it released in India earlier this month. So I don't know how much it made domestically so far.
I saw a Letterboxd review that got me really excited about Pope's Exorcist, where it says there's a scene in the film where Russell Crowe as a Pope's Exorcist has to get a cup of coffee to work up the energy to negotiate with a demon. And I'm like, okay, that's the stuff I want to see in a movie, you know?
He's very it's like, what if Columbo was an exorcist, kind of?
It did not outgross Renfield. It made $9 million domestic opening.
Okay.
But actually, that's just looking at the opening. The Renfield opening might be a little bit smaller because I'm looking at all the way up to Tuesday. So disregard that.
Either way. But also, if you want to see Russell Crowe dressed like Orson Welles, if Orson Welles was a priest driving around on a little tiny Vespa scooter, Pope's Exorcist is the movie for you.
Yeah, I didn't even like see like a screening invite or any kind of hype going into the movie. So I had to see it.
I had to raw dog it live like opening night. That's one way to put it. It was worth it. It was kind of worth it. It was fun.
All right, Renfield is at $8 million for domestic opening. So okay, Will, you were right. We finally got there.
Yeah, I was just looking up the opening weekend. It actually not only did The Pope's Exorcist outgross, it was number two this weekend behind Super Mario Brothers movies, of course. But John Wick Chapter 4, and was it like its fourth or fifth week, has also outgrossed the opening weekend for Renfield. So that's not great.
I'm not too, you know, and I think a lot of that too is that like people aren't aware of Renfield. Like people don't remember that from the Dracula lore. I don't think so. I think people are a little bit like, oh, what is this? Like they probably didn't even see the trailer. They probably see the name Renfield and like, Mario, I'll watch that.
I don't know. I mean, that's something I definitely want to talk about with Clint, where it's like, I'm a little concerned with like where Nicolas Cage's like box office status is at this point. Cause it seems like there's the undeniable meme-ness of him. And like people obviously love talking about him, you know, showing gifts and all these things, but between The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent and this, which are like his two only like wide release films in like quite a bit of time, at least where he's like the star of them, or like the headlining star. It just seems like audiences, unfortunately, just aren't really showing up. Granted, I didn't love either film, so I'm sympathetic towards that. But I'm also kind of like, I mean, I want Nicolas Cage to do well. I want him to get, you know, as many plump roles as he can. But it does seem like audiences are reluctant to actually show up when it comes to new movies in wide release with him in them.
Well, and that's the snakes on a plane effect, isn't it? Right. It's sort of the internet is very much not real life. And so you can meme Nick Cage all the live long day. But when it comes time to actually plopping down $14 to go to a movie theater to see a movie where he's not even the star, really, he's got the and credit. There's not really much to go on, especially when he like doesn't really like to do conventional stuff. Like, I mean, he's a weirdo. And when he takes major studio projects, it's to do something weird and interesting, like playing a version of himself or playing Count Dracula, which, by the way, I know we've talked about how he's good in this, but I do want to say the chompers were a problem for me because they muffled his dialogue to the point where sometimes I couldn't make out what he was saying. It felt like he was trying on a new pair of dentures. I feel like they needed to do something, but like
I'm actually deaf, Clint.
I don't know what to tell you, but I mean, I knew the words he was saying, but they were just mush mouthed through those chompers. It felt to me like he was fighting them the whole time, and I just wanted some sweet release from my boy.
I think that the guy, it's one of those things where his reputation has really followed him since like all of the VOD stuff. And I think that that's a general audience's thing. And even though us, like, we know that he's capable of a movie like Pig and Mandy, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people are like, if Nick Cage is in it, it almost sort of sounds to them like, oh, I can wait. Like, I can rent that or something. Mm-hmm. It's not quite he's not quite the big screen draw that the internet sort of begets of him, kind of feeding itself on his like mythos. And I think that's kind of where he's at. It's going to affect, I think, future projects for him. But I'm not necessarily opposed to that because I prefer when he does movies like Pig. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing for the guy's talent. I think his best movie.
And you know what? I think he prefers those movies too. Yeah.
I wonder if it's like almost like, you know how like Disney's kind of in this weird place where like they put so many movies on Disney Plus that people expect them to be on Disney Plus, and so people don't go to the theaters. It's almost like there's that effect with Redbox, where Nicolas Cage has made so many Redbox movies that people just wait to see him on Redbox as opposed to going to the theaters to see.
And then when you look at Nicholas Holt, I think people, I bet there's a Hollywood studio exec who's like, if only we'd gotten Timothée Chalamet. You know, because I guess there was this like assumption maybe that Nicholas Holt is a draw for younger people, which doesn't really make sense, I guess. But like,
I think he is to some extent. I don't think he's like an A-list star, but I think he's, solidified.
I think he's a heartthrob to the same internet people who lionize Cage, because he's very because we've said before, he's this beautiful, weird boy who is very good. He's got the leading man good looks, right? And he's got the charisma for it, but he likes to take those idiosyncratic roles. He likes to play big. He likes to play strange. He likes to play little weasel, weird little guys. Say what you will about the menu, but I thought he was great in it. And I think he perfectly captured that kind of try hard foodie. And that the innate patheticness of that kind of character. And that works well for Renfield. Like he's good in it when he wrestles with the material that he's been given.
That's the thing. Yeah, I think to that point, Menu isn't a movie, I think, that brought people in because of Holt. I think a lot of it was Taylor Joy and Ralph Fiennes, personally.
Mm-hmm. For sure, for sure. And or the succession factor, because it feels like food succession.
Oh, John's favorite show, Succession.
Which, and many was directed by the sort of house director for Succession.
Yeah, yeah.
So Will John, is making fun of me because...
You do not like
Succession. Yeah, go ahead, Will.
Yeah.
Well, John, he likes to pride himself on like watching all these hip shows that I haven't watched yet. And he like makes fun of me because he's like, how do you not keep up with prestige television, all this stuff? So I've been watching Succession. I figured like, oh, he must be watching that because it's like the show everyone talks about. He's like, oh, I haven't watched that. So now I just kind of make fun of him about that. But then also like he talks about anime all the time, knowing that I don't really watch a lot of anime and don't know a lot about anime. So anytime he brings up anime.
We'll get him, Clint. He's coming. Yes.
I decide I'm just going to talk about Succession to kind of get back at him. So that's
for you.
That's
Succession for him. Succession is your Mobile Suit Gundam, the Witch from Mercury.
If you say so.
Sure.
Yeah. Will Ashton. That's a great anime. You would like it. It's got passion.
I'm watching it right now. I'm halfway through. Yeah.
Yeah. Second season is simulcasting right now. And sorry, this isn't Rookie Pirate Radio, so I guess we don't.
It's basically a high school teen girl anime with robots.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty great. And also, Will, we can mention too, we're hopefully to do a thing about Suzume, which I think you were interested in seeing because you know the director.
Saw your name. Oh, no, not personally. No, I know of the director, which I guess is a big deal for me for anime because I'm, it's like, him, the Paprika, Perfect Blue director, and Miyazaki, of course. I feel like I'm limited in that respect. But I will say, before we veer entirely off of Renfield, I do want to say, to go off of Clint's point, I can kind of see what you're talking about with the teeth, but I also feel like Cage really relishes every line of dialogue in this movie. And I just feel like he's like having so much fun playing Dracula. Like, I feel like he kind of knows that this project isn't really probably going to be up to snuff with him. But I think he just like, look, this may be my one only time to play Dracula. I was kind of born to play this part. I'm going to make every single moment of screen time count with me in it. So I will say, like I said before, I mean, if you're going to see it for him. Like, he is truly such a blast to watch. And I think he is the only part of this I find genuinely funny outside of some of the gore effects. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for as little as I've said positively about the film, I do think he is tremendous in this.
And I agree, especially when he confronts Renfield in his new studio apartment and plays the same sort of like a vampiric spin on the kind of abusive, passive aggressive relationship dynamics. That stuff is fun. I wish there was more of that.
The YOLO poster gag had me in stitches.
I mean, there you go. To me, like, hearing Dracula say studio apartment just makes me yearn for what this movie could have been. Like, it's just like, like, that's the stuff I want out of this movie. Like, I agree that, like, making it modern day is probably for the worst, but it's like, if they could have leaned more into that, that's fun.
Yeah, I like when Dracula gets to be a bit of a sarcastic bitch. Like, he's you miss me so much. Like, that. Yeah, when he gets to really lean into the sarcasm, it's really, really fun. I just wish there was more of it. That's why I wish the movie was just about that dynamic, and they fleshed it out so gave it some blood, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say though, I also really like the practical makeup effects, especially for Dracula when he's like being reformed. I thought those all looked tremendous as well.
And I like the aforementioned recreations of the Todd Browning original, sort of plopping our boys into the original framing and all. And like, and I think they even sort of go through the Hammer horror stuff from the 60s and 70s. They emulate that look, like in that first flashback. Like, that stuff was great. That's kind of what I wanted the movie to be.
Yeah, especially since I feel like Cage's performance seems to be kind of a mix of, you know, like the Bela Lugosi, obviously, and then obviously you got some of the Christopher Lee, and then like the Klaus Kinski from Nosferatu the Vampire. It's like that mix of the three, and probably some other influences. But I did appreciate that he was, you know, he does play it big in the right moments, but he's also fairly restrained. So I thought that was very commendable as well for him.
Hot take, I also saw a little bit of Richard Roxburgh in Van Helsing in his Dracula.
Oh, I can see that, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's play the Rotten Tomatoes game. Let's see what other people think of this movie. And if you can guess correctly, I know, Clint, it's been a while, but I assume you still remember the rules. And because I think the last time we had you on was Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, right?
Yeah, that was the case. So, yeah. It was like ages ago.
Will House said that he was spoiled on the Rotten Tomatoes score, but it might have changed. So, you know, we'll see. We have 213 reviews counted. I assume one of those is yours, Clint. And, you know, I didn't do a review of this one. We had somebody else review it for In Between Drafts. So let's look at the tomato meter here. Clint, what's your guess? What do you think the RT score is? It's 213 reviews. What do you got?
I think it's probably hovering between fresh and rotten. So I'm going to say 61.
A 61% guess from Clint. And then, Will, it's your turn. What do you got? You said you were spoiled, but...
Last I'd heard, I think Clint was on the right track. I heard it was like fluctuating between 59 and 60%. So I'm going to go, you know, lower. I'm going to do the Price is Right thing. I'm going to say 58%.
Well, Will, you made the right call because you're closer. You're only one away. It is actually 57%. It's even lower. People have their fangs out for this movie. I think there's a little bit of that, like, you know, the negative reviews are starting to come in a little bit more. But, all right, what about audience score? You have 500-plus verified ratings in a few days for general audiences to come out and let the world know what they think. So this time we'll start with you, Will. What do you think the audience score is?
So I forgot to mention that the theater where I work, the Harris Theater, we've been showing Renfield as kind of a way to see what will happen if we play more mainstream films, and we justify it by doing some Dracula films. So I actually got to watch the original Dracula this weekend, so that was on my mind during this review. But anyway, I was gonna say, I've been seeing a lot of people's direct reactions to the film. It seems like people coming out of the film are positive, if not very positive. Like, I haven't really talked to many people, at least who've come to our theater, who have been outright negative on film. Granted, that's a very small pool of the people seeing Renfield, but maybe not a lot, because not a lot of people are seeing Renfield. But
people who would watch Renfield and an art house movie in Pittsburgh.
Nevertheless, that's all to say, I think audiences are probably more forgiving of this film, and I think they're going to ultimately be positive, if not like enthusiastically positive.
So
I'm
going to
say 68%.
68% guess from Lashton. What do you think, Clint?
Well, I think that audience scores for Rotten Tomatoes often tend to be very self-selecting things where like people are either going to go to defend it or go to hate on it. So it's very, very difficult. But I think people are more likely to review movies and audiences in audience scores if they like it. So maybe it's somewhere in the 75. I'm going to say that.
Once again, Clint is a little bit closer, Will. You were closer on the last one. It's just that Clint was so confident with that. I was like, wow, Clint's getting them all right. 80%. So you're only five away. So it's even higher. Audiences are going to listen to this podcast and be like, I don't know what Will and Clint are talking about. Awkwafina is a star.
I also feel like, I mean, I'm sure you guys have experienced this too, but like normal, like audiences have kind of an oppositional relationship with critics, especially at this point. So I feel like if audiences are going to see that critics are giving it a drubbing, that they may even out of spite like a movie more than they might otherwise without that influence.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm hardened when it's like the same score between both, you know, like people come together.
I have been amused by this recent thing that I've been seeing going around. Not only, I think it's kind of being sparked by people being like, critics are out to get these movies we like with the Mario movie and stuff. But I've seen somebody being like, man, you guys, referring to Renfield, like, man, you guys aren't supporting these original movies that are coming out. It's like, I get in theory what you're trying to say, but this is based on Dracula, one of the oldest IPs, if you will, ever. So, you know, this isn't really an original film.
That was kind of weird. But that said, despite what we're seeing for the Rotten Tomatoes score, the post-track, which we don't usually talk about the post-track on here, but it's a film survey that happens in the U.S. And I think it's more like widespread and things like CinemaScore. But people gave it an 86% positive score on the whole. So there's something there, it seems. But what about CinemaScore? Now, for CinemaScore, of course, that's the A to F. And this time I'll start with you, Clint. What do you think the CinemaScore is?
I'm going to go on a limb and say B minus.
Clint guesses B minus. Will Ashton, he's looking at his phone. I wonder what he's looking at. Hopefully he's not cheating.
My email, I have proof.
He's probably...
Someone emailed you the CinemaScore. I get it.
Well, I already got spoiled in this one, so I thought you weren't going to ask me.
Oh, I forgot you did mention you got spoiled on it.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't going to guess. But, well, I mean, Clint wins by default. What it is. Right.
Because he avoided it better. Yes. B minus.
that you know of.
Everybody wins. And then we'll finish off with Letterboxd. Letterboxd, I mean, it's kind of abysmal that we only have 29,000 watches for a movie like this. With this budget, for reference, Mario, I think it was like at, what, 200,000 views last week? It's pretty wild. But average rating, start with you this time. Will Ashton, what's the average?
I'm going to say 3.2.
And Clint Worthington, what do you think?
I'll say 3.5.
It's kind of an even, because Will got this one. So it's like, it's like we need a tiebreaker or something. 3.2 is the correct. And you know what? That's fine. You guys can tie. You guys can enjoy the spoils of victory together.
Yes, we could do the Metacritic to break the tie. I don't know what it is.
Pass. All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Only because I just want to do a quick little, like, what are we going to talk about next week? And I'm curious, Clint, what you're looking forward to the most next week, because Will and I are going to be seeing Beau's Afraid today. I don't know if you've already seen it, Clint. I think there's already a review for it on the spool, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Oh, and I reviewed it for Consequence as well. I managed to catch the April Fool's secret screening, or I got teased as to what the, cause I had gotten that, email about like, hey, go to the Alamo, cause we have a new Alamo in Chicago in Wrigleyville. And, which is a weird place to put a movie theater, but I digress. They were like, oh yeah, go to this, like, you know, this April 1st screening of the Midsummer Director's Cut with a thing, like, we'll get a 10-minute preview of Beau Is Afraid. And I was like, oh, I mean, I've already seen it. It's the week of my wife's birthday. We have family in town. But then I found out from a fellow critic who, like, basically, like, tipped the hand. Oh, and also the publicists were like, you really don't want to miss this one. I got wise enough to, like, see it all the way on, like, April 1st. Yeah.
That's kind of funny. I really dug it. Because I went through the exact... the exact situation where it was literally also like a couple of days after my wife's birthday. And I had the same sort of like, you really don't want to miss this, John. It's at the Alamo. And I was just like, I'll see Beau's Afraid later. Right. So I'll let my wife know that other people made the other choice, and then
it's true. Thank you, Clint. I very much guilted my wife into letting me go because I'm like, I have to do it for work, hon. Because also in Chicago, our press screening for Beau is Afraid is tonight, the same time as Evil Dead Rise, which I have to see for work as well. So I wouldn't have been able to see it anyway.
I decided, you know what, I'll see Evil Dead Rise at a public screening because I'm dealing with the same thing. And so I'm just like, you know what, that's fine. I'll go see Evil Dead Rise later. I want to see Beau's Afraid more. And I'm not reviewing either for In Between Drafts. I wiped my hands clean. And so we have other great writers taking care of those. And, you know, I'm probably going to review something like, I don't know, Joyland or something. But you were going to say,
You guys, so lucky, get to be like, I have to choose between seeing Evil Dead Rise early or Beau's Afraid early. You know, granted, I'm getting to see Beau's Afraid early as well, but I mean, I had to pay for it. I didn't get the the press screening option. But you know, I'm just being envious over here that's such an opportunity is being afforded to both of you.
We wish you such charmed lives. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just need to start your own website, Will, with like a vaguely yellow color scheme. And then all of a sudden the emails will start pouring.
Yeah,
exactly. Just give yourself that veneer of legitimacy. That's all we have. That's all we have got to do.
Cinemaholics won't give you that. That's for sure.
Yeah. all right.
We didn't talk about Mafia Mama. I did get a screener link and I decided, no, thank you. I didn't watch it. And honestly, it's because I forgot about the link and it expired. But anyway, 20% of Rotten Tomatoes. I think we're good.
Big Italian week, I guess, between Mafia Mama, Pope Exorcist, and I guess it's in some respect Renfield with Nicolas Cage. So yeah
and cool Super boy, Mario Brothers.
Oh yeah, going. Yeah. It's yeah.
Yeah, is anyone in Evil Dead Rise Italian? I don't know. Now, I assume we'll be talking about Evil Dead Rise this weekend and maybe do a bonus for Beau's Afraid. We'll see. There's also Guy Ritchie's The Covenant, which I missed the screening for that one last week, but I don't know if I'm that interested in that. And there was also Chevalier, which the screening for that was last night, and I missed that. But that one I do really want to see at some point. But I assume we'll talk about Evil Dead Rise and Beau's Afraid. Is there anything I'm missing, though? Is there anything else that's like, you know, Ghosted on Apple TV Plus? That's coming out.
Yeah, that is coming out.
I'm certainly looking forward to Somewhere in Queens, the directorial debut of Ray Romano, Un Film de Ray Romano. But yeah, I mean, I know that in my area, I'm finally going to be getting to see How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which I know you've been very eager for me to not only see, but for us to talk about. So maybe we can do...
Great movie. I hope we can talk about it. Clint, did you see that one already?
Yeah, I did. I saw it at SIFF last fall, and then I watched the screener again a couple weeks ago. I have yet to write my review, but I did enjoy it.
It's a fantastic movie. I hope if it's playing in your area, please check it out. But yeah, Will, on a similar note to all that, I also am really looking forward to Plan 75, which I'm hoping to finally see. Played at Cannes last year, and it's been on my radar for a minute. And so that is finally going to be hitting more theaters pretty soon. So, all right. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode of Cinemaholics. Thank you, as always, for listening. And thank you, Clint, for coming on the show. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we say goodbye?
Well, first of all, thank you again for having me back. Again, you can find my stuff at The Spool and also Consequence. And I write about TV for RogerEbert.com. And also, I just filed a piece for Polygon that is going to be a big, dumb Easter egg rundown on the new Power Rangers special that's coming out tomorrow. The reunion special that is pretty bad, even by Power Ranger standards. But it has a lot of, like, you know, just fun little Easter eggs for us 90s latchkey kids who grew up watching it.
Love me some Power Rangers content, you know.
Yes.
No justice for the original, but the 2017 one that's dead in the water.
Yeah.
And, you know.
A good movie whose worst aspect is that it's a Power Rangers movie. Like, really? Like, when they become Power Rangers, it becomes less interesting?
Fair assessment.
Which is weird.
Yeah, once they start transforming. Interesting take. All right. Well, we'll see you on the next one. From the Internet California, I'm John Negroni.
From the Internet Pennsylvania, I'm Washington.
And you can sign off to Clint if you want, wherever you want.
Do I have permission to speak?
From Transylvania.
Yes. And from The Spool and RogerEbert.com, I'm Clint Worthington.
See you next time.